From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a new breed of nonprofit organization, the nonprofit for-profit. We talk with Bill Shore about building Share Our Strength. It's raised $30 million to feed the hungry without federal funding through entrepreneurial ventures and by convincing writers, chefs, and others to donate their talents. Also, hip-hop music about loneliness and alienation, love and spirituality. We meet Prince B, co-founder of the group PM Dawn. Critic Dave Marsh called the group the Beatles of hip-hop. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Toy Story. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Colorado Congresswoman Pat Schroeder has announced she will not seek a 12th term in office. Schroeder says the number 55 had a lot to do with her decision.
I woke up and decided that this year I turned 55 years of age. This has been a really momentous year, and that I got put in the National History Museum of Women. I also got put on Ollie North's list of the 25 most dangerous politicians in America. And I also lived through a tremendous upheaval of the Congress, which has been exciting and fun to participate in. But I'm still 55 years old. And this is the day the Congress has lifted that speed limit. So I decided, since I've spent most of my adult life under that dome on the floor representing the wonderful 1st Congressional District, it is time today to announce that I'm going to move on at the end of this term.
Schroeder has served in Congress for 22 years. Former Minnesota Senator David Durenberger has been sentenced to 1 year on probation and fined $1,000 for his conviction on charges of stealing public funds by abusing his congressional expense account. The judge rejected a request from prosecutors who wanted Durenberger sentenced to home detention. In an emotional statement in the courthouse, Durenberger said he has already been punished severely for his ethics violation. The House has unanimously passed and sent to the president legislation to slap tougher disclosure requirements on the thousands of lobbyists in the nation's capital. It's the first overhaul of lobbying laws in half a century. President Clinton has said he'll sign the measure. The president told a joint session of the British Parliament today that the U.S. will fulfill its responsibility to Europe by sending 20,000 American troops to Bosnia. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from London.
In his first official visit to London, President Clinton made a triumphant appearance before Parliament. He reminded the British that the U.S. had stood by them during two world wars and the Cold War and would be there again in Bosnia.
And I pledge to you that America will live up to its history and its ideals as well. We know that if we do not participate in Bosnia, our leadership will be questioned and our partnerships will be weakened. Partnerships we must have if we are to help each other in the fight against the common threats we face.
The president also spoke to a domestic audience. Mindful that Americans are skeptical of his plan to send troops to Bosnia, President Clinton said, "We will prevail if and only if the people support the mission." In London, I'm Mara Liasson.
NATO defense ministers meeting in Brussels have endorsed the Bosnian peacekeeping plan. Formal approval is expected by Friday. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up just over 11 points at 5,089.29 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up 5.25 points. This is NPR News. 19 people have been indicted in Miami on charges of importing and selling more than 7,500 pounds of Colombian cocaine in the U.S. Police put the street value at over $61 million. Some of the cocaine was hidden in shipments of frozen fish. The Justice Department has fined drug maker Warner Lambert $10 million for concealing problems with the quality of an epilepsy drug. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The government says that between February 1990 and May 1992, Warner Lambert shipped out batches of Dilantin that were different strengths and then hid the manufacturing problems from federal government inspectors. The Food and Drug Administration discovered the problem while investigating fluctuations in three other Warner Lambert drugs. According to the Justice Department, the Dilantin problems created a risk of harm to consumers. It's important that each batch of epilepsy drugs be identical so fluctuating chemical levels don't cause patients to have seizures. Federal law requires that a company notify the FDA immediately when a drug fails quality tests so that it can be kept from consumers while the problem is corrected. Warner Lambert has expressed regret that the violations ever took place. A spokeswoman says they've put into place strict procedures designed to ensure this type of activity never happens again. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
China has executed two women convicted of being ringleaders in the biggest corruption scandal there since the communist takeover. The government says the case was designed to show its vigilance against graft. Vice President Al Gore has reportedly received a bill from the Walt Disney Company for over $8,000 for the tailor-made Beauty and the Beast costumes he and his wife Tipper wore on Halloween. The Post says the bill will be paid by the Democratic National Committee. The bill was submitted after ethical questions were raised about the Gores accepting the costumes for free. More than half of the cost was incurred when a Disney costume designer and a makeup artist were flown from Hollywood to Washington. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Bill Shore, left traditional politics for work that he finds connects in a more direct and meaningful way to the community. After serving as Senator Gary Hart's political director and Senator Bob Kerrey's chief of staff, Shore now works full-time directing SOS, Share Our Strength. It's a hunger relief and anti-poverty organization, which he founded in 1984. It provides financial assistance and other types of support to more than 450 community-based organizations across the country that help to feed, shelter, teach, and support Americans living in poverty. When it comes to fundraising, SOS has the golden touch. Just this year, it will raise about $16 million. Shore thinks his approach is a model that can be followed by other nonprofit organizations in these times of government funding cutbacks. He says he typically doesn't ask people for money. He organizes people to contribute their skills and talents.
We ask chefs to cook for us at Food and Wine Benefits. We ask writers to write for us, and we publish anthologies, and we do events like Writers' Harvest, in which writers all over the country read from their work one night of the year. We've also gotten involved in a large number of kind of marketing and promotional and merchandising partnerships with different companies and corporations around the country. So we've been a weird hybrid, Terry, of an organization that both raises money and distributes money. Most grant-making organizations, most foundations operate either from an endowment or from some large source of funds. And we only have the money that we raise or earn every year.
How do you decide who to give the money to?
Well, we've got an established grant-making process. We do two things. We receive applications from literally thousands of community-based organizations around the country who are doing anti-hunger and anti-poverty work, and our doors are open and always will be open to organizations like that. We actually fund about 450 of those organizations. The other thing we do, though, is we try and proactively, hopefully strategically, seek out organizations and approach them so that we can fund organizations who are doing really great work. So we're trying to be as least reactive and as most strategic as we can be. Our funds typically support the kind of emergency food assistance efforts that you would associate with an anti-hunger organization. The other thing we do, though, is try and get beyond just the emergency food assistance. We try and complement that work with efforts that'll have greater bang for the buck. We try and get more kids involved, for example, in the school breakfast program. It's a federal entitlement. There's 13 million kids in this country who, by age and nutritional status and income, are eligible for a free or reduced price school breakfast, but only 5 million kids get it. So there's 8 million kids slipping through the cracks, either because their schools have not had the hardware that they need, which in many cases Share Our Strength provides, or the parents aren't aware of the program, or what have you. But it's a program that's completely paid for and funded by the federal government. So there's a whole range of things we do like that, including some community development work, some job training work, some nutrition education work, all aimed at not just feeding people, but helping people get in a position where they're going to be able to support themselves.
I'm interested in the way that you go about raising money. You usually don't ask people to give money. You ask them to give their services. And you tell the story in your book about how this approach evolved. You'd sent a letter to a lot of chefs asking them to donate money, and you got virtually nothing in return. What happened?
Right. Well, when the organization first started, that was the idea, was that we would kind of have the Share Our Strength logo would be like a Good Housekeeping seal of approval. And if you contributed money as a restaurant or somebody in the food service industry, and our initial idea was to very methodically organize that industry, if you contributed money, we would send you a logo. And we sent out thousands of letters, and every day the mailman came and went, and there was really not a response for quite a long time. And we finally got a contribution from a very well-known chef named Alice Waters at Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California. And she said, let me know what else I can do. And we asked her to write a letter, and she wrote to some other chefs. And we ended up getting a few more contributions. But what we started to realize was that really the last thing people want to do is put money in the mail. We ended up developing a program called Taste of the Nation, which we do in partnership with American Express. And one of the things we found is that chefs would rather participate by coming to a food and wine benefit, donating their time and all of their food and the help of some of their staff, when they would probably spend about $800 or $900, maybe as much as $1,000, really out of pocket cash to make that happen. They would rather do that than send us $100 once a year in the mail. And I think it's because people want to be connected. They want to be involved. They don't want to just write a check, drop it in the mail, and not know or have any contact with the organization that it's going to. The other example that really struck me and that I felt I learned a lot about in terms of the psychology of fundraising for nonprofit organizations is we put together a book of short stories with Random House's Vintage Books called Louder Than Words, and we asked really well-known writers around the country to donate work to us, new work. And, you know, an example that comes to mind is Ann Tyler, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist, called up and said, yes, she would love to donate a story. She gave it to us. We sold it to the Ladies' Home Journal for, I think, $4,500, and we included it in our book. Now, if I'd have called Ann Tyler and asked for $4,500 over the phone, I don't think it would have been a very long conversation. But she loved the idea of donating a story, even though it took her 8 or 9 weeks to write, and she called up every few weeks saying she wanted to re-edit it and would take a little bit longer. And a check would have taken, you know, 10 seconds, but this was a much more meaningful way for her to contribute. So that's what we've been looking for, and it's really reflected in the name of our organization, Share Our Strength. We literally try and find ways for people to share their particular strengths, what it is they're passionate about, and we'll take that and we'll convert it into money.
Now let's get back to the chef's event, Taste of the Nation. What's the event?
The event is an event that takes place every year in April. It's called Taste of the Nation, and in about 110 cities around the country, all the top chefs and restaurateurs, wineries, other purveyors of food come together in each city at a location, and they essentially put on a big food and wine benefit, but they donate everything. 100% of the proceeds from that event get distributed back to community-based organizations doing anti-hunger work. We did the event for the first time in 1988, and it raised about $260,000. The year after that, it doubled. The year after that, it doubled again. This year, 1995, we did the event, and it netted out, after all expenses, $4.2 million. So that's a significant amount of grassroots charitable activity to take place in the course of, you know, just a week's time.
And how'd you get American Express into the act, and what's their function?
Well, American Express is the national sponsor of the event. They had an interest in, I think, trying to hit a couple targets with one shot, which was to say that they were interested in being involved as a good corporate citizen, but they were also interested in doing something that would improve and enhance their position in the restaurant industry. There's an awful lot of restaurateurs and food service establishments around the country that have to decide whether they're going to accept the American Express card. And they found that working with our organization, they could really build very good relationships with a lot of these merchants and potential customers for them. So they've basically underwritten the organizing cost of the event through a sponsorship fee, and that enables us to distribute 100% of the proceeds.
Now, in addition to asking people to donate goods and services, you also have a more entrepreneurial approach. Your organization, Share Our Strength, sells a lot of things, from gift boxes of hot sauce to T-shirts, books, aprons, watches, lapel pins, caps, and tote bags with your logos on it. How did you get into that entrepreneurial part?
Well, one of the things that really struck us from the beginning, and this is really one of the central points of Revolution of the Heart, is that there are simply not enough charitable resources in this country or probably in the world to really effectively solve the social problems that we're trying to deal with. Charitable generosity is incredibly important, and it does an enormous amount of good, but it's just not enough. So we wanted to create new resources. We didn't simply want to be in the position of redistributing wealth. We wanted to be in the position of generating wealth of our own. It's what I would call community wealth, in the sense that it doesn't make my wallet thicker or my house bigger or anybody else who works at SOS, but it certainly enriches the communities in which we work. So we got into the business of both creating lines of merchandise, also of licensing our logo. There are organizations, for example, like Fetzer Vineyards, which is a winery that markets to restaurants around the country. And one of the things they have found is that they are in a stronger position to go into a restaurant and get that restaurant to stock their wines if it has the SOS logo on it, because the odds are that that restaurant is helping in some other way with our hunger activities, and they would be sympathetic to that. So we actually enter into marketing, licensing, and promotional contracts with a number of large companies around the country, wineries like Fetzer and Gallo, companies like American Express, and the relationships we have with them, and this is one of the things that makes Share Our Strength different, I think, from most nonprofits, is that we are not receiving money from their charitable foundations. We are entering contracts with their marketing departments or their sales department or their promotional department. And that's commerce. It's business. Same with the books that we put together. I was mentioning Ann Tyler contributed to one of our first anthologies that we did with Random House. That is a straight business transaction between Share Our Strength and Random House. And to the same extent that any small business is actually making the economy grow and making the GNP grow and creating jobs, I feel that Share Our Strength is doing that, and that we're in a position of, as I say, not just redistributing other people's money, but creating wealth of our own, just a different kind, community wealth.
My guest is Bill Shore, founder of SOS, Share Our Strength. He's written a new book called Revolution of the Heart, A New Strategy for Creating Wealth and Meaningful Change. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Shore, founder of Share Our Strength, a group that raises money to fight hunger and poverty. Now let's get to what you describe as the nonprofit mentality, which is to keep costs low, you work with a lot of volunteers, your professional staff is paid as little as you could possibly pay them. What's wrong with that approach?
Well, it drives me crazy, is what it does, because you just can't build as professional and as powerful as an institution as I think you need to do to deal with some of the very difficult issues we're dealing with today. I mean, if you were starting a business today, if Terry Gross were starting a software company or a restaurant or a bakery or whatever it was, you know, the notion that you would start it by asking some people to volunteer for you and by having donated equipment and having old secondhand used furniture and not having a great advertising firm or communications firm, you would be destined to fail. It's a very competitive marketplace out there, both for for-profits and for nonprofits. And I believe that nonprofits need to pay good salaries, they need to have full benefits, they need to avail themselves of consultants and communications experts and design strategists. If the work you're doing is important, if you think it's important, I think you've also got an obligation to market it, to promote it, and to bring every resource that you can to the table on your behalf.
How do you set your salary at Share Our Strength? You don't believe people should be martyrs just because they work for a nonprofit. On the other hand, if your salary is too high, people would probably figure, well, why should I be sacrificing my time to pay his big salary?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, we try and we do two things. At Share Our Strength, we try and, first of all, set salaries that are designed to enable us to get really good people, and most of our senior staff has been with the organization for 7 or 8 years now, which I think gives us a big advantage in terms of really being able to get our work done professionally. The other thing we do, though, is we hired a salary consultant to let us know what the spectrum of salaries were across the range of nonprofits. And the salary consultant took our organization and compared it to other organizations of our size and of our revenues and let us know for each of the positions in the organization what the high end was, what the low end was, and what the midpoint was. In my case, I set my salary below the midpoint for just the reason that you've described, so that if anybody questions it, they'll at least know that what my salary is less than the median for nonprofits across the country, and I think that would be reassuring to them. The only other thing I'd add, Terry, is that the really important thing is I think not to worry about salaries and administrative costs, but impact. I mean, the measuring stick should be impact. Is Share Our Strength getting done the job that we say we're getting done? If we are, I don't think people should be troubled by any of the rest of it.
Would you like to see the government get out of the world of funding nonprofits?
No, it'd be a disaster. I mean, no nonprofit or no collection of nonprofits are ever going to be able to make up the resources that government can provide. So I think government funding of social services is critical. From a practical point of view, there's no substitute for it. And just from a moral point of view and from what's right, I think it's, a strong activist government is what this country needs. That said, there are things that government can't do. I think government can provide the funds. I don't know that government can always run and execute the programs. I think there are things, frankly, that only you and I and our colleagues and neighbors can do at the community level that can really affect people's lives. We've got a program at Share Our Strength right now called Operation Frontline, where we train the chefs who have helped us raise money, and then we deploy them into maternal and child health clinics and community centers where there's families with fixed incomes. They teach nutrition education, grocery shopping, food budgeting. They are connecting with people over food. These chefs don't consider themselves social workers or political or community activists, but they're providing a service that, I don't know that government could provide. Government could certainly support it financially. That would be a very valuable thing. But I don't know that government workers can solve social problems.
You first got into the business of raising money to combat hunger after the Ethiopian famine. You were reading about it, I think it was 1984?
Right.
And you write that you were very moved when you were reading that hundreds of thousands of people might die soon, and that when you were that moved, you realized it was the first time in years that you'd had an opinion of your own.
Right.
Because at the time, you were working for Gary Hart. You'd been in politics, and when you had an opinion, the opinion was, what will the candidate I work for think of this? How will this affect him politically?
Yeah. I mean, I guess everybody in their life comes to the point where they realize that it's time to start thinking for themselves, and I hope most people come to it earlier than I did. But that's exactly what happened. I mean, I had worked so closely with Senator Hart for so long that my reflexes were to think about what he would say about an issue, what kind of press release he would put out about an issue. I was really, geared all of my thinking towards what was good for him as opposed to also thinking about what my own opinions were about things. And this tragedy in Ethiopia in 1984 was of such enormous magnitude that hopefully you couldn't do anything but have an opinion of your own. And I didn't start to pay attention to that kind of impulse because it was the first time I'd had it in quite a while.
You loved politics when you were growing up, and you say that you believed in government's power to make life better because you saw your father do it. Your father ran the district office of your local congressman, Bill Moorhead. I think this was in Pittsburgh.
Right, exactly.
What looked so good about what your father was doing?
Well, it was enormously attractive then and now. Some of my most vivid memories are of going up to the corner pizza parlor with my dad and it taking, 2 hours to get up and back for all the people who would stop and ask about their Social Security check or could he get their son-in-law into the country or could he get somebody into the Air Force Academy. And he was just helping people on a one-on-one basis. You could literally see their eyes light up when he would give them some reassurance. He represented to them this enormous power of the federal government. He was their closest connection to it, and it made me realize that government can help people that way. But it also made me realize there's no substitute for people being involved in a one-on-one basis like that.
Did you feel connected to the people that way when you were working for Senator Hart?
I didn't. No, I really didn't. I mean, I worked in his Washington office. I traveled widely on his behalf and with him. But basically, we were working on getting legislation passed and working on sometimes symbolic victories. Or, you know, if you look at what's gone on with Congress over the last month in terms of this clash over how to keep the government running, I mean, these are basically huge symbolic battles that have consequences down the road, but are not, you know, really what my neighbors are thinking about affects their lives. And I think people in most communities feel the same way.
My guess is Bill Shure, the founder of Share Our Strength, and this is a group that raises money and then gives the money to groups that work with feeding the poor. How do you handle it? Since your new book is about nonprofits and how alternate ways for them of making money, how do you handle it when you get a direct mail solicitation?
Well, I don't read most of them. I get an awful lot of mail, and I'm on a lot of people's lists. But to me, that's just not that. That's not the way that I want to personally get involved. I don't know. I toss out most of them, and we tried direct mail at SOS once, and it turns out that most people tossed out ours. So I think we're even in that regard. It's just you know, even the best direct mail efforts get a 1% or 2% return. The other reason I think this is important is not just because it's not financially rewarding necessarily, or at least that it wasn't an organization. To me, the key thing is to get people engaged beyond money. I mean, we're not going to out-fundraise hunger. Share Our Strength is not going to be successful in out-fundraising hunger. This is not like the Jerry Lewis telethon where we're trying to get the thermometer to pop through the ceiling at X number of million dollars. Ultimately, we need to get people, average people, citizens, who up until now have considered their citizenship responsibilities to vote and to pay taxes. We need to get them engaged in a hands-on way, in a way that can really be transformative both for themselves and society. And direct mail doesn't do that. I mean, direct mail is the least connected way of getting somebody involved in your organization.
When you're working down a city street and you get panhandled, what do you do?
I do a couple different things. Sometimes I walk by and I always feel lousy about it. Most of the time, if I can talk to the person who's asking for money and let them know where there's a food assistance program, because in our neighborhood at Share Our Strength, for example, in Washington, D.C., there's a truck that comes to the corner a couple times a day. So I'll let them know about that. I mean, one of the problems is the people that you see on the street are really just the visible tip, and I think of an iceberg, and there are literally thousands of people who are hungry and who are homeless who do not panhandle. And they take advantage of the resources that exist. Usually if somebody's on the street asking for money, it's because they've chosen not to go to a shelter, in some cases for good reason, or to another type of facility. They're very often using the money for drugs or alcohol. They're very often mentally disturbed. It's not true of everybody on the street, but the higher percentage of people on the street, and it really misrepresents who's hungry and who's homeless in this country.
Bill Shure is the founder of Share Our Strength, SOS. He's written a new book called Revolution of the Heart, a new strategy for creating wealth and meaningful change. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we meet Prince B of the hip-hop group PM Dawn. His idols include Brian Wilson and Prince. In fact, Prince B does an acoustic version of 1999 on the new album Jesus Wept. Billboard calls the album one of the tops of the year. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Toy Story. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. PM Dawn is a hip-hop group that doesn't follow some of the more predictable hip-hop patterns. Their lyrics don't brag about being macho or tough. They're about being lonely and alienated. PM Dawn's new album, Jesus Wept, has a spiritual edge. The group's musical idols include the Beach Boys as well as Prince. Critic Dave Marsh calls PM Dawn the Beatles of hip-hop. Critic Anthony DeCurtis called PM Dawn's melodies as beautiful as any pop music has to offer. And Billboard called the new album one of the tops of the year. PM Dawn is a duo made up of my guest Prince B and his brother JC the Eternal. From their new album Jesus Wept, this is Downtown Venus.
And I'm trying to be by myself, myself. Visual dreamers, no one dreams enough to give me hope. I'm downtown Venus, and I'm trying to define myself. And I keep saying,
Prince B, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you very much.
I think you've been moving more from rap to singing.
Yeah.
How come?
Well, I wasn't actually a rapper even when I was a rapper. Everybody kept telling me that I was. I didn't know what I was. I just sort of was accepted by whoever, you know. And because I wasn't singing, everybody just sort of said, oh, well, if you're not singing, you're rapping. And that wasn't actually what I was doing. I was just sort of talking, because when you rap, you just sort of do things in a rhythmic pattern, and it's a lot different from what I was doing. And I didn't change my voice at all. I just sort of sound the way I sound all the time. So when it came down to what I wanted to do, it was just going to be something very personal and very close to hip hop, which is what it is. But it actually wasn't rap at all.
A lot of rap has a very in your face style, and your style of rapping was much more, not about bragging, but more about being lonely and unsure of yourself.
Well, pretty much, yeah. Alienation.
Yeah. Well, why don't I play something from your first CD? Mm-hmm. We'll hear some of your rapping on that. This is Set Adrift on Memory Bliss. Baby, you send me.
It's one of those deja vu things, or a dream is trying to tell me something, but will I ever stop thinking about it? I don't know, I doubt it. Subterranean by design, I wonder what I would find if I met you, let my eyes caress you, until I meet the thought of Mrs. Princess who, often wonder what makes her work. I guess I'll leave that question to the experts, assuming that there are some out there, but probably alone, solitaire. I can remember when I caught up with a pastime intimate friend. She said, but you're probably gonna say I look lovely, but you probably don't think nothing of me. She was right though, I can't lie. She's just one of those corners of my mind, and I'll just put her right back with the rest. That's the way it goes, I guess.
What do you think about this record now?
Well, it's very confusing. You know, I don't actually know what I was feeling at that particular moment. I just sort of go with emotions, and that's just one clear fact of how I just sort of go with things that I feel emotionally. And I think Set Adrift was very much representative of how I am mentally. You know, I have no idea what I'm doing.
No, how did you first start rapping?
When I was young, I just hip-hop took a big place in my life because there was nothing else that I wanted to do. Me and my brother had a conversation about, you know, what do you actually want to do for the rest of your life? Do you want to, you know, work a 9-to-5? Do you want to, you know, be a salesman? I don't know. It's just, we couldn't think of anything else to do but being a DJ. It's the only thing I wanted to do for the rest of my life was play records. But fortunately for us, DJing sort of evolved into the sampling artistry. So I still get to play my records, but I get to play them in a different way.
So you were DJing at parties when you were young?
Mm-hmm. Pretty much at home, at parties, or wherever, actually.
Tell me what it would be like to DJ at a party and how old you were when you were doing it.
I'd say I was like 14 or 15. And, you know, it was just like, it's weird because people think when you sample a record, it's like stealing, but it's not. It's like you're almost there with the record. When you play a record, when a DJ plays a record for someone, it's almost like he's playing the record, you know what I mean? And the record is the DJ, you know what I mean? It's like, and when everybody likes the record and everybody goes crazy, it's the same vibe as if you wrote it, you know?
When did you go from DJing into actually rapping? Did you rap at parties?
Well, yeah, I did, actually. For a little while, it was me and my brother, we were Courageous Cut and DJ Minute Mix. So, and then I started rapping, and I changed my name to Courageous Rap and Minute Mix. So then I just started writing whatever the hell came out, so I just changed my name to Prince B, Prince Is, Prince Exists. So that was where, pretty much everything started from there.
How did you start doing more singing? How did you go from rap to singing?
Well, I was always writing songs. I just sort of separated them. I thought that I was writing songs just to be writing them, just as a form of escapism. And then I was writing raps because that, you know, I was an inner city youth, and that was just what was prominent. You know, I didn't really think too much of my songwriting, so I just sort of did it for myself. And you know, I was singing some of the songs to Jarrett one day, and he just was like, you know, why are you setting this stuff aside, you know? So I just sort of combined the two, so to speak. I didn't really want to do one or the other. I just sort of did whatever came out, and sometimes they came out all mixed up together.
Right. Did you have confidence in your voice when you started to sing?
Hell no. I barely have confidence in my voice now. It's just that there are a lot of people that say, oh, I like the way your voice sounds, and sort of make me blush all the time, but that's about it.
You sometimes sing in a falsetto.
I sing in a falsetto a lot. I think all the time I sing in a falsetto.
You more comfortable in that range? Do you like the sound of it better there?
Well, I just like using my voice as an instrument. I don't really use it like other singers use it. It's just that, you know, I could never be a Whitney Houston. I could never be a Bobby Brown. I could never be a Luther Vandross. So I just sort of use what I got. You know, and I don't know why a lot of times, especially lately, I've been writing at a really high sort of pitch, and it's just like I can't get rid of it, you know.
Now, on the new CD, Jesus Wept, mm-hmm. you do a version of Prince's 1999, and mm-hmm. you do it like as an acoustic ballad.
Uh-huh.
What made you decide to rework this song in this way?
Well, I just wanted to sort of do some songs that I could emote them in a spiritual way. And I thought that if I did it really intimately and personal, that people could see the spiritual side of what was going on in that song or what I thought was going on in the song. And that was pretty much what attached me to doing 1999, because it's so intimate, it's so personal, it's so very much about the future, and I'm so very much afraid.
Why don't we hear it?
I was dreaming when I wrote this. Forgive me if it goes astray. Destruction, no, I didn't even care. They say 2000 party's over. Oops, out of time. So tonight I'm gonna party like it's 1999.
parties of hoops at a time. So tonight I'm gonna cry like it's 1999. No, 1999.
That's Prince B from PM Dawn's new album, Jesus Wept. We'll talk more with Prince B after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Prince B of the group PM Dawn. You were exposed to a lot of very diverse music when you were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
I think your stepfather played in Kool and the Gang.
Uh-huh.
So what did he play at home?
Well,
for you?
He was percussionist in Kool and the Gang. And like, well, not actually in Kool and the Gang. He was in an early incarnation of them. Like, I think they were called the Jazzy Acts then. And, you know, they were all from Jersey City. He's from Jersey City. And they just sort of played around and stuff. But, my dad was into other things, you know. My dad was into things like Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell and that type of stuff. And it was just a lot of everything all the time, you know. I'd listen to Joni Mitchell, I'd listen to Sly and Family Stone, I'd listen to, you know, Kool and the Gang. I'd listen to Donovan, I'd listen to everything, you know. And it wasn't that I never really put anything in a category. I just sort of liked what I liked, you know. And
were your tastes considered odd by your friends?
I don't know. I never really showed my friends that particular side of what I was listening to, you know. I knew what everybody else liked, so I just sort of stayed in that area. I was sort of separating everything. You know, when it came down to hip-hop, it was hip-hop, and that's all I dealt with when it came to my friends. Anything other than hip-hop was strictly a bedroom thing. <You know>?
Did you ever have to pretend that you didn't like Joni Mitchell or Bob Dylan?
No, I don't think it actually came up.
In what other ways were you separated from everyone else?
Well, see, me, I lived in the same 10-block radius my entire life, say 20 years or so, all the way up until maybe 4 years ago. And
this is in then, Jersey City.
Yeah. And then I went around the world, so, and everyone's sticking a microphone in my face saying, well, what do you think about, you know, what do you think about this place? And I didn't really have much to say. All I know is those 10 blocks, you know. And if you sort of went 5 blocks in one direction, I got robbed, beat up, and chased by white people. If I went 5 blocks in the other direction, I got robbed, beat up, and chased by black people. It didn't matter to me who my friends were. I just sort of picked everybody due to my emotional attachment. But in America, when you get older, everyone always asks you to pick a side. You got to pick a side. Where are you going to be at? So, and my reaction was, you know, I can't pick a side. You know what I mean? If I'm really going to pick a side, none of you people are on my side. So, you know, I learned to be an escape artist at a young age.
Escape from what?
From everything.
From being hit? From being beaten up?
From everything. If I didn't have my imagination, I wouldn't be here.
How did you make your first record?
I had a choice. I was gonna either go to some weird school or go make
some
a demo.
Some weird school?
some weird, I think it was about some computer school.
Uh-huh.
I was gonna go to, and I had a choice, either pay for the tuition or pay for a demo. So I said, I'll never forgive myself if I didn't do the demo. So I did the demo, and actually we only sent our demo to 3 places, and one of them picked them up, and it got into some sort of weird line, and we ended up on G Street Records, and that's how it is today.
Now, how much of the music on your new record is played by musicians, and how much of it is sampled? And is that balance changing?
I would say pretty much 35% of it is musicians, you know, and the rest are samples. I mean, it's just, I'm a sampling artist. What can I tell you? It's just, I love listening to records. I love feeling vibes from other people. I love being influenced by everything, you know, and that's why the music takes the turns that it does, you know, because there are no boundaries in who we want and who we listen to. We can take a Sly Stone sample, we can take a Joni Mitchell sample, we can take a James Brown sample, we can take a Cal Jada sample. It doesn't really make a difference, you know. It's just all vibes and how everything feels and how everything emotes itself, you know.
So when you want to sample another record, when you want to use a passage from another record as part of your own music, mm-hmm. do you have to, like, call the lawyers and have the lawyers call the publishers and then negotiate for rights? Or are there some people who are famous for not allowing their records to be sampled?
Yeah, I know, like, actually, Beatles don't not allow their records to be sampled. I think that was more of a Michael Jackson thing. Because I met Paul McCartney, and he's pretty much down with it, so. And who else doesn't sample? You can't sample the Rolling Stones because the guy, not actually their fault either. It always has to do with someone else, you know.
Oh, the lawyer, the publisher, right.
Yeah, you know. The only people that, you can't sample Led Zeppelin. But recently, Led Zeppelin let us clear a sample for one of our songs. And it was weird because, like I said, Led Zeppelin doesn't clear any samples for no reason whatsoever.
Did they like your music a lot?
I mean, it was pretty much a big split, but yeah, they cleared the sample.
Choose a track for me where you really like the way the sample worked out.
I'd say My Own Personal Gravity. You know, and that was a sample from The Hassles. That it was Billy Joel's first group, and it was you know, I heard the riff, and it the song just sort of came out on its own. You know, it took maybe like a half an hour to write the song, and it was very. You know, it's hard to explain how songs come out because there's no actual formula for it all. But My Own Personal Gravity is something that is sort of had a life of its own. You know, it just sort of came out. Boom. There it is. Here I am. What's up? You know?
Good. Let's hear it.
What could be lonely about you?
A little bit, you know. I started playing a little bit of keys only recently. Started trying to learn, but I think the reason that the songs come out the way they do is because I have no idea what's going on. You know, I just sort of hum out melodies and say, "Could you please play that in a particular way?" You know, and Cameron, our guitarist, he's always going, "Oh man, I can't do that with my guitar." And he's always trying to figure out ways to make things sound different and original. So. It's cool, you know, not knowing because you don't know what you can and can't do, you know, so it's almost limitless.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, hey, it's cool.
Prince B of the group PM Dawn. Here's more from PM Dawn's new album, Jesus Wept, a cover of the David Byrne song Once in a Lifetime.
Time isn't after us. Time isn't after us. Let the days go.
Music from PM Dawn's album Jesus Wept. Coming up, a review of Toy Story. This is Fresh Air. The Walt Disney Company got into the computer business early. Way back in 1982, they released Tron, which took place mostly in a fairly crude version of cyberspace. But it's a long way from Tron to Toy Story, the first entirely computer-animated feature film. The picture was conceived and directed by John Lasseter, a former Disney animator who went to work for Steve Jobs at the Northern California computer graphics company Pixar Animation. Now he's come back with what has turned out to be the number one movie in the country. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Toy Story.
Newt Gingrich whines about having to use the rear exit of the president's plane. The president, not too long ago, was telephoning people like author Ben Wattenberg and confessing his inadequacies. We sometimes seem to be living in a country governed by children. So the world of Toy Story looks especially familiar. The toys we watch coming to life on screen also live in a world run by children, or in this case, by Andy, the 7-year-old who throws them around and takes them for granted and who at any birthday or Christmas may decide that some shiny new creature ought to take their place. The movie's hero is a pull-string talking cowboy named Woody, wonderfully given voice by Tom Hanks. And Woody is especially worried because he has the most to lose. He's Andy's favorite toy, and therefore the ringleader of all the other toys, Mr. Potato Head, Etch-a-Sketch, Rex the plastic dinosaur, and so on. But the end of Woody's reign is inevitable, and it comes at the hands of a new space-age action figure, a toy so blissfully ego-ridden and dumb that it doesn't even know it's a toy.
I am Buzz Lightyear. I come in peace.
Oh, I'm so glad you're not a dinosaur!
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Now, thank you all for your kind welcome.
Say, what's that button do?
I'll show you.
Buzz Lightyear to the rescue!
Oh. Hey, Woody's got something like that. His is a pull string, only
it. Only it sounds like a car ran over it.
Oh, yeah, but not like this one. This is a quality sound system. Probably all copper wiring, huh? So, where are you from? Singapore? Hong Kong?
Well, no. Actually, I'm stationed up in the Gamma Quadrant of Sector 4. As a member of the elite Universe Protection Unit of the Space Ranger Corps, I protect the galaxy from the threat of invasion from the evil Emperor Zurg, sworn enemy of the Galactic Alliance.
Oh, really? I'm from Play School, and I'm from Mattel.
That's Tim Allen as the voice of Buzz Lightyear, who instantly becomes the most high-tech gadget in Andy's bedroom. In fact, Woody's fear of Buzz will look familiar to any working grown-up who's been looking over his shoulder lately at those young Turks equipped with computer knowledge and the names of mysterious new rock bands, the up-and-comers who seem certain to replace us all one day. Part of this movie's considerable magic is the magic that's at the heart of all the great Disney animations. The fantasy world up on the screen is a reflection of the traumas and terrors that the audience experiences in a more mundane way every day. If Woody's afraid of growing old and obsolete, Buzz is coming to grips with who he really is, and eventually they both find themselves confronting the existence of real evil in their world, in the form of Sid, the demented little kid next door who likes to blow up playthings in his backyard. He's a serial toy killer. Sid's dark world is beautifully imagined, but then so is everything else in this film. When Buzz and Woody escape into the real world, it too has become a fantasy land. Especially the local pizza parlor, which is a kind of Planet Hollywood of pizza. The computer animation gives everything on screen a lovely sense of solidity, of surfaces that light can actually play on, and the writers have made the most of every possible gag, all of which leaves only one question about Toy Story. And the answer is, yes, Your kids will like it almost as much as you do.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolfe. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.